Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are Roberta J. M. Olson, curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and returning J. M. Pasikoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we're talking about their book. It is gorgeous. It's a wonderful book. Cosmos, The Art and Science of the Universe. Jay, Roberta, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
And we're delighted to be here with you.
It will be much fun to spend the hour with you.
Man, it's... When Jay told me about this book, I didn't know what to expect. It's an absolutely gorgeous book, but it's also, it has a text that matches the pictures. So this is really the history of human observation of the heavens, as well as a pictorial observation of the heavens. How did you two get together to write this book? Why don't we start with Roberta?
It's a long story, but thank you very much for seizing on the connections between text and images. We met, actually, under the aegis of Halley's Comet in 1986. I had published in Scientific American an article about Halley's Comet that Giotto had actually painted the first portrait of the comet in its 1301 apparition in the Scrivegni Chapel in the scene of the Adoration of the Magi. And I went on to write a book and do a show at the Smithsonian called Fire and Ice, A History of Comets and Art. And the European Space Agency had, when they saw the Scientific American article, had telegrammed me. You can see the technology we're in 1985.
Wow.
Whether they could name their spacecraft going to the comet, which was the first one to sort of circumvent it and take pictures of the comet on all of its sides, if they could name it Giotto. I mean, asking me, which was really incredible. Anyway, Jay's colleague in the art department invited me to give a talk when Halley's Comet made its appearance in 1985-86. And in the audience, there was Jay. And
he started
asking me questions and talking, and we realized there was this great chemistry, and we realized that we were on the same wavelength approaching it the way things used to be when science and art were much more involved with investigations together. And it was very exciting. He invited me with his children. One of them sat on my lap, Deborah. We went out to look at the comet with some of his graduate students, and his wife made us dessert afterwards. And we've been collaborating ever since. What kind of a conjunction is that?
That's pretty amazing. First of all, that's a great story.
And so then I heard that somebody was coming to give a talk about Halley's Comet. So, of course, I had to go. It was arranged by an art professor I knew, who was a friend, Sam Edgerton. And we went to hear the talk from this art historian. And I realized that about two-thirds of our Halley's Comet talks were similar, except my last third was astronomy and her last third was art. Anyway, as you just heard, we hit it off. And we've been working together ever since. So we really were literally brought together by Halley's Comet.
I love that.
Isn't that wonderful?
It is wonderful. I love that story.
And the NEH has loved it. The NEA has loved it. The Getty has loved it. They have funded many of our explorations because really what we do, the book is the outcome of really in-depth studies of various unpublished funds of material and also gathering from all over the world archives that will now go to Williams College, the Chapin Library. But it was really sort of, you know, on the ground, boots on the ground, going after these things that many times had never been photographed. For instance, at the Royal Society, we went out in Scotland. We gathered material from all over the world. So it's been exciting.
It's amazing because I'm familiar with a lot of paintings and drawings of celestial objects. There's a lot in this book.
It turns out that the Royal Society in Edinburgh has at the observatory there has a major collection of art related to comets that somebody has made.
Oh, wow.
100 years ago. And I think a little prior to that, we had heard, or Roberta had heard somehow, that the exemplars for the Nuremberg Chronicle had been found. Now, the Nuremberg Chronicle was from 1493, so this is really old. And it turns out it's a chronological history of the world with pictures of comets scattered throughout it with dates. And we had read in some magazine articles that one of those was the oldest picture of Halley's Comet. But then we realized somehow that there were only six different comet images, and they turned them in around, upside down, backwards. It wasn't really a picture of Halley's Comet. It was just a figurative comet. So one of our questions is, when did the drawing become accurate enough that you could actually get some scientific data from it? But anyway, this was laid out before 1493 when it was published, and the exemplars, which are just the sketches, the layouts, had been hidden for security during World War II somewhere in Nuremberg, and we learned that they had been found. So we applied to the National Endowment for the Humanities for twin travel to collection grants. I may be the only scientist who's ever gotten one of those travel to collection grants. It's the NEH, after all. But we did take a trip together to Nuremberg to see these, which turned out to be actually a little disappointing, aside from the provenance, because they really were just rough pencil sketches. But then we did get a full grant from the Getty Foundation, which, of course, runs these big museums in California, and they have a big Getty grant fund, and that sent us on the, a semester's sabbatical for me, and we did go to the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh as part of that.
And that resulted in another book called, a very similar book, Fire in the Sky, Comets and Meteors, the Decisive Centuries in British Art and Science. So this is really the third major collection that we've done, and lots of other articles. But you're a book lover, so you just going back to the Nuremberg Chronicles, what was so important about it is that these exemplars were layouts with illustrations, because it was illustrated. And so they laid them out, the text and the illustrations, and then they moved the woodblocks, the four woodblocks, around for the different comets, but they had movable type. So it was, and Jay is a collector of astronomical books, illustrated astronomical books. He has a major, major collection. So for us, it was very instructive in terms of the history of books as well as the history of comets and the history of how to document the world, because the Nuremberg Chronicles is also filled with early views of important cities as well as other things. It was an attempt to give a history of the world.
As a matter of fact, since we're just having a conversation, I happen to have gotten an invitation today to go to Nuremberg. It turns out that you all know that the Galileo first turned a telescope on the heavens and discovered the moons of Jupiter back in 1609. But it turns out that there was another, he was down in Italy. It turns out there was an astronomer up near Nuremberg, in the Gundeshausen near Nuremberg, named Simon Marius, M-A-R-I-U-S, and he discovered the moons of Jupiter independently one day after Galileo. So how's that?
Oh, whoa.
Different calendars. One day? The Gregorian calendar.
So wait a minute. Are you sure it's one day?
You actually have to do some calculations, because Galileo got terribly upset, because Galileo first wrote down his notes in early January 1610, and the other guy discovered the moons, but he didn't publish right away, in 1609. But it turns out, because of the calendar difference that Roberta just mentioned of 10 days, it worked out to one day later. So
they were on pins and needles for a long time.
Yes.
So publishing in scientific circles really hasn't changed.
Yes.
Get there first. Get it first out there.
You know, it's an incredible thing. I mean, here we are in a day when at night there we have the Leonids, mid-November, the meteor showers, which are so strong, which are the result of Comet P. Temple Tuttle. And this morning I woke up on the television set to the statement that, it was really unbelievable that SpaceX was outdone by a huge bolide, a huge fireball that fell out of the sky as part of these Leonids.
Wow.
So we may think that we have everything figured out, but we don't have things like that figured out, and astronomy still makes headlines, and the visuals, which is somewhat what brought Jay and I together, that astronomy and art produced by artists, they're both examples of using your eyes and visual acuity. And this is what has sort of been the central thread throughout our research, that astronomers and artists at first, before photography, were doing the same thing. They were using their eyes, and before the telescope, certainly. And before the telescope, artists sometimes, because astronomers and astrologers, that was another link, artists frequently were such careful observers, and perhaps were slightly eidetic. That is, they saw like primitive people. They sort of had things emblazoned on their eyeballs and their brains. They began exploring celestial phenomena in their works of art, like the Lorenzetti and Gaudi and Giotto in the Renaissance.
One of the things that I thought was cool is that several of Jay's photographs are in this book. And as a matter of fact, there are several photographs also of from Williams College, or at least from the Williams College group who observed that. And I thought that was amazing to see some of Jay's photographs in this book.
Yeah, so we work on comets, and I work especially on solar eclipses.
I know, from talking to you before, I knew you're passionate about eclipses.
So that's how
He's
we got involved with Mark, because I did a book on the sun with my colleague Leon Golub for the same publisher, and then Mark learned about this book with Roberta. But let me say one more thing about the sun and eclipses. Just today, I was visiting a colleague here where I am in Brookline, Massachusetts, who have built equipment to take to the solar eclipse in over Antarctica on December 4th, coming in just a few weeks. And these people have, with NASA support, gone up in a NASA Gulfstream to photograph the streak in the sky of a reentry of a Japanese spacecraft carrying dust from a comet. And it looked in the sky a lot like the picture that Roberta sent me from the web today. And also these other occasional bolides that come in. And so... They are building some major equipment to take to Antarctica as part of our eclipse expedition.
You're listening
to space junk is polluting.
Oh, I know.
Space junk is polluting that some of the things that we see, like the meteor showers.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and returning J.M. Paskoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we're talking about an extraordinary book that they put out together. And you can tell, if you've listened to them before, they're really passionate about this project. Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. I want to talk to you about one of the things that was cool for me. Every chapter is a different phenomena. Comets, the sun, the moon, and so on and so forth. It was interesting for me to read the text and trace the sort of scientific changes and evolution that were going on, and then comparing it to the artwork. You know, you start out and there's this Ptolemaic view of the universe, which was complicated. They made it work, but can somebody just address the Ptolemaic view of the universe from Ptolemy?
Well, it's all wrong, of course, but Aristotle, 2,000 years ago, thought he knew everything, and people for 1,000 years thought everything that Aristotle did was correct. And later, in about AD 140, Claudius Ptolemy elaborated on Aristotle. So Aristotle had earth, air, fire, and water in the middle, and then so that's the earth, and then the various planets and the sun and the moon going around it. But the ancients, even when you look in the sky and you see those bright planets, sometimes they're going forward among the stars from night to night, and then sometimes they reverse a little bit, what we call retrograde motion. And in fact, this week it's been spectacular with the crescent moon.
Sky
and Jupiter up to its left, and Venus down to its right. But anyway, we have these retrograde loops. So Ptolemy made up the idea that the planets go on circles around the Earth. It's all Earth-centered, geocentric, but that on these big circles, which are called deferents, there were littler circles called epicycles. And if you're going on the backwards part of the epicycle, that's going a little faster than the forward part of the whole circle on the deferent, then it looks like it's going back a little bit. And so that lasts for hundreds of years. And then when people started making more accurate observations, especially Tycho Brahe in Denmark in the late 1500s, you could see that wasn't accurate enough. And the story is that people were putting epicycles on epicycles, and it got complicated. But in any case, in the 1500s early, Nicholas Copernicus, who was a church canon, he wasn't a priest, but he was working for his uncle, who was a bishop, he figured out that if you had the sun at the center and Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, etc. around it, then if the Earth is going faster than Mars, for example, and you pass it by, Mars looks like it's going backwards for a few weeks or months.
Right.
And he could explain the retrograde motion as an optical effect that way. And, of course, that's what we believe now with this so-called Copernican revolution that did take 100 years or so before it was accepted in general.
And he wrote De Revolutionibus
in
1543. And, of course, the Catholic Church was very against that and caused lots of problems with Galileo as well. And Tycho Brahe, of course, tried to combine later in the 16th century the geocentric and the Copernican together. And, of course, that didn't work either. And as Jay said, it took over 100 years before everyone accepted the fact that the sun was at the center and that the planets, including Earth, revolved around it.
Now, we're going to run out of time because we're only doing a 30-minute show. We could talk about this book for 5 years.
Oh, at least.
Okay. But let's talk about the sun for a bit. And I just
and
want
we're
to bring
on to the next book, too.
Okay. Oh, my God. Okay. Let me talk to you a little bit about the sun chapter because there's some things I've always wanted to know. Some of the first telescopic studies of the sun can be traced back to Galileo Galilei. And he has sunspot observations that he drew. Now, was he just staring at the sun through a telescope?
Well, we don't really know, and Galileo did go blind in the 1530s, so people wonder about that. But on the other hand, people just had cataracts and things. People go, you know, have vision impairments now. But basically, we assume that they didn't have the filter material we have now, but you can put your telescope a little out of focus and project the image onto a wall. So we assume that that Galileo was using projection.
And in fact, in the book, we have projections by Hevelius. He had a special machine to do that. And then we have a representation by Donato Creti that shows the same thing through, at this point, a telescope, that you would project it onto a piece of paper or a canvas from the telescope.
Now, one of the other things that I realized from reading this book is solar eclipses crop up in so much artwork, and it was amazing.
Well, they crop up for you with so much artwork because Roberta has found them.
That's right.
No.
And I want to thank you for that, Roberta. But it's amazing how many artworks, especially with things like the crucifixion, in painted scenes of the crucifixion, they painted as happening during a during a solar eclipse. But I think I remember reading. Hasn't it been shown that probably there wasn't a solar eclipse?
Jay and I have wrestled with this for a very long time, and there probably wasn't a solar eclipse, but it's a metaphor. And the same thing was true with comets. Anytime there's a change of ruler, the death of someone important, people saw something in the sky, and they would associate it with that passing. So it's an automatic symbol, and in ages past, when you didn't have electricity, those symbols were even stronger than they are today. So it's a kind of metaphor. If the sun is eclipsed, and Christ, for Christians, he was thought of the Son of God. So it's the sun is eclipsed. It was more than a metaphor. And, of course, in the Bible, in all the Gospels, it does talk about there was a darkness that fell over. And so they used that also. And so the writers never said it was an eclipse. But other people thinking about it, embroidering on it, including artists and intellectuals, assigned that to the iconography.
Now, how early on were people able to predict the occurrence of solar eclipses? Is that a relatively recent phenomenon?
Well, it actually goes back a couple of thousand years. Mm-hmm. It turns out that just coincidentally there are cycles of the sun and the moon that balance out every 18 years, 11 and a third days. So the third of a day is a rotation of the Earth a third of the way, but people followed that and could predict the date. And after 54 years and three times 11 and a third, 34 days, it would come back to more or less the same place on the Earth. So they knew when there was going to be an eclipse to within a day or two.
It's amazing because that idea of being able to predict a solar eclipse is also featured in fiction, like A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain.
Absolutely. And the Babylonians had it down. But it's only recently, and isn't it true, Jay, that they're still fine-tuning this? And with the equipment that we have now, it's much easier to calibrate exactly when.
There's a word associated with it.
Have a detailed computer calculation to the nearest second.
There's a word that's associated with eclipses I always love, and that's syzygy.
Yes.
Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes, I'm a little, not upset, but in the little Scrabble dictionary, because my wife and I have now played 509 almost consecutive games of Scrabble that I've listed in the
Don't tell me, document. And you've played the syzygy word?
but we do have the official Scrabble dictionary from Merriam-Webster, and one of the pages has a keyword of syzygy on the top, but I've never got to play it on the board.
How many points would that be? That would be a lot.
Well, yeah, the YZ. Well, Z is 10 and Y is 4.
Wow.
The question is whether you get one of those on a triple word score, but I did get Z on a word with a triple word score this last week, one of my all-time high.
Congrats.
I want to ask you, there's an artist who painted some images of the eclipse. I think it's Jacob Balde. It was images with faces on them so that the moon always looked like it was like some kind of
Well, that's
evil.
The man in the moon.
Yeah, and he looks really angry.
Exactly. And I think he didn't want to be eclipsed, right? And no, that was the man in the moon tradition, which actually goes back to antiquity. The spottedness on the moon, which was described in antiquity by Pliny and other people, which is really the mare on the moon. But they began to organize it in terms of a face because they allied it with the Roman goddess Luna.
That's right.
So the anthropomorphism came in, and we have the man in the moon.
I also want to talk, we have just minutes left, Etienne Leopold Trouvelot. What an amazing astronomical artist he was.
Well, do you know what he started out as? He started out as a biologist, and he was doing some experiments in the eastern United States, I think Massachusetts, on controlling some plants, so he brought in some gypsy moths, and one of them escaped, a pregnant one. And so all these infestations we've had for the last decades come from Trouvelot, and he was upset that he gave that up, and he went and I think to the director of the Harvard Observatory then and asked if he could do some work with them, and he wound up changing to astronomy and sketching. I even have a wonderful mask for COVID now with his 1878 eclipse portrait on it that's widely available. But he did a set of chromolithographs. Roberta can tell us exactly what that is. But he had original drawings, and then copies were made and of about a dozen different things, including Jupiter and Saturn and an eclipse.
Oh, wow.
The original pastels are in the observatory in Paris, and the wonderful chromolithographs, which basically means color lithographs, were published by Scribner's, and they are spectacular. And many of them are reproduced in Cosmos.
It's amazing, and for listeners, I want you to realize that they bring the artwork all up to modern and contemporary. So there are artists, just in this chapter, Paul Klee, Delaunay, Roy Lichtenstein, all of them are included in this book, as well as the older reproductions. Photography, I don't really have time. Well, we have a little bit of time. Photography must have...
We started talking, obviously, with the Sun book that Leon Golub and I did. So I have a website at solarcorona.com. And if you click on that, I think the first book is my book with Roberta. So it's easy to find, and links to the publishers. It was published in England by Reaction Books, but that's distributed by the University of Chicago Press in the United States, and that's all linked at solarcorona.com.
And Jay is a photographer in his own right. And
that's right.
Well, you know where photography comes from and who named it such? It comes from the Greek word for phos, for light, and it was an astronomer, Sir John Herschel, who actually named photography photography.
We're all out of time, and we're going to have to think.
Oh, no.
We're going to have you both back, because I really want to talk about comets. My guests tonight have been Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and J.M. Pasikoff, Field Memorial Professor of Astronomy and Director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we've been talking about their book. It is stunning. Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Roberta and Jay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.